This interview with Tariq Ali was recorded on October 14, 2002, and broadcast on WBAI New York on Doug Henwood's Behind the News show, October 17. Tariq Ali.
Before we get to the topic of Iraq and the grand strategy, what did you make of the Pakistani elections? You've argued that Pakistan has been overwhelmingly secular, and now there's a big rise in the vote for the religious parties. What do you make of this?
Well, it's very worrying. There are two explanations for this. One is that the military didn't allow these secular parties to function fully. It kept their leaders out. However corrupt these leaders were, they were kept out of the election. There was a big campaign to try and split one of these parties and form it into a pro-military party. So there was a lot of chaos and confusion. But most importantly, none of these other parties were critical of the United States. And so the Islamists in Pakistan were the only political force criticizing American imperial policy. Of course, they did it in their own way, but because they were the only force, they were seen as the only real opposition in the country. And the fact that they've captured two key provinces, small provinces, but key in the sense that both of them border Afghanistan and one borders Iran, is quite worrying to me, because both these provinces, Balochistan, which borders Iran, and the Northwest Frontier Province, which borders Afghanistan, have a history of being secular and leftist. So what we're witnessing really is the cumulative result of what's been going on in that region for about 20 years. It's frightening. And the other point which has to be made is that the turnout in the country as a whole was incredibly low. 25% of those entitled to vote voted. So it's the lowest turnout we've seen in Pakistani elections, and I think the reason for that is that people are just fed up, tired, and cynical. They saw this election essentially as a fake election, and large numbers of them didn't bother to go and vote.
A lot of the cheerleaders for the war, including some born-again leftists, the war in Afghanistan, that is, said that all the dire consequences that critics of the war had predicted haven't materialized. Is this actually maybe the first materialization of one of these dire consequences?
Well, one of the things which I predicted at the beginning of the Afghanistan war was that the Taliban would not fight, they would be defeated very quickly, that they would melt away and return to Pakistan, and they have done. And the provinces where the Taliban people are the two provinces where the Islamists have won. And a lot of other supporters of the Taliban have been creating mayhem in other parts of the country. So Pakistan is actually suffering from the consequences of this war. And the victory of the Islamists in these two provinces is the first sort of public sign of it, but there have been lots of other signs even before the election. So if I was the military, I would be, or the Musharraf section of the military, I would be quite worried. And there's, as Afghanistan itself is concerned, there's absolutely no sign of stability in that country. I mean, you know, the West holds on to two cities, Kabul and Kandahar, but it's unlikely to be holding them on too long if a war is going to be waged in the Middle East. So it's a very messy situation in the region.
Now let's turn to that war in the Middle East. What do you make of this demonization and imminent attack on Iraq? Is this, I mean, is it, to be crude, is this about crude oil, or is there something broader at stake?
Well, I think it's both about oil and it's broader. I mean, let's put it like this, that if Iraq was situated in a part of the world which was very poor, there were no resources in that part of the world, I doubt whether anyone would be very interested in what was going on there. But I think this is really to do with two things. One is that the United States would like to have a regime in the region, apart from Israel, which it can use as a very pliable puppet in order to remap the region as a whole. It's part of a policy which they're considering very seriously. Secondly, of course, neoliberal economic hegemony doesn't extend to Iraq. So once they take the country over, I mean, the Iraqi opposition have said they're negotiating already with the oil companies. and that oil companies belonging to countries opposing the war will be punished. So it's very, very blatant. And thirdly, I guess the latest expression of the Bush doctrine doesn't simply talk about Iraq. It more or less says that it reserves the right to carry out preemptive strikes against any country which threatens to overtake it and challenge its hegemony. So what we are witnessing is the formulation of quite a bold, though foolish in my opinion, imperial strategy to preserve United States dominance in the post-communist world.
Whatever you think of Hartton Negri's empire, there was a sense that, at least during the Clinton years, the days when the Third Way was riding high, that there was some multilateralism or collegiality to the process of empire, and it looks like the Bush people are really trying to assert pure American primacy. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think this isn't true. I mean, I think the Bush people are much more open and much cruder in how they go about it. And their arrogance and disregard for their allies is very noticeable. But there have always been these two strands in American foreign policy thinking. I mean, you know, there's been Teddy Roosevelt, who's been a gung-ho imperialist, and there's been Woodrow Wilson, who has been a careful multilateral imperialist, taking other people with him. So there's nothing new about this. I mean, at different times in U.S. history, different political leaders have reacted in a way they see fit, and I think the Bush people have used 9/11 to remap parts of the world, and they think that they can get away with it, and they don't particularly mind if their allies don't go along with them. Blind occupation of Iraq and the imposition of a puppet regime, I think they can get away with it temporarily, possibly for a few years, but it will store up enormous resentments in different parts of the world, and it could begin to force some European powers to become more and more unilateral themselves.
Well, what's the likelihood of the EU splitting away from American domination and developing its own independent political and military power?
Military power seems difficult at the moment, but, you know, it's interesting that the United States itself put pressure on the Germans to come in and bomb Yugoslavia when there was no UN sanction for the bombing of Belgrade, but they did it. And curiously enough, it is that German participation in the bombing of Belgrade and in the war in Afghanistan which has given them the strength to say now, no, thus and no further, we're not going to back you on Iraq. But the fact is that the German Army and Air Force have been used, together with that of the United States in some actions, so the German state must be thinking, why should we always be acting in the interests of other people? And sooner or later, I think certainly Germany will begin to act much, much more independently. In the European Union, you've got to see a sort of split. There is a Franco-German alliance of sorts. It's quite weak and fragile at the moment, but it's there. These are the two strongest countries. Britain, they don't take seriously, because Britain, in reality, is the Washington's Trojan horse in Europe, while it pretends to the Europeans that really we are your Trojan horse in the United States. So stay with us, we can wield influence on behalf of Europe, but no one in Europe takes this seriously. Then you have jokers like Berlusconi in Italy and Aznar in Spain, who tend to back Blair and the United States. So Europe is basically split, and it's this big division which prevents it from playing a role which it could be playing.
Let's get back to Iraq. Saddam Hussein is certainly not a nice guy. Let's talk a bit about how he came to be in the history. I mean,
he was a friend for a long time of the West. It's worth reminding ourselves that in 1958 there was a revolution in Iraq inspired by the developments in Egypt 2 years previously. There was a whole wave of radical secular nationalism which wanted to kick out the West from the region. There was a big move to unite Egypt, Syria, and Iraq into a United Arab Republic. And the Iraqi people supported the revolution and toppled the monarchy, which had been imposed by the British on this country. And the king's uncle, the crown prince, was Hamid Faisal, was executed. The prime minister was hung on the streets. There was just wild rejoicing. It was like scenes from the French Revolution being repeated in Baghdad. And there were, at that time, three major currents in Iraq. The army, and which was by that time dominated by Nasserite nationalists. The Communist Party of Iraq, which was a very, very strong political force in the country, dominated the oil workers' trade union. And you had the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath is a secular party with a very strong presence in Syria, in Lebanon, and Iraq. It's actually founded by a Christian called Michel Aflaq, a Lebanese, who became a very hardcore Arab nationalist and felt that there should be a united Arab nation. Very strong in Syria. The Iraqi and Syrian Ba'aths then fell out with each other over tactics to be followed in the region. And the Iraqi Ba'ath decided to make a bid for power. It conquered power, and then within it, a gangster faction, which was responsible for sort of street actions and bank raids and stuff, led by Saddam, was encouraged by Western intelligence agencies to take power because they felt that they would never share power with any other group and would actually destroy the enemies, or hit their own enemies, who were also very hostile to Western interests, which was the Iraqi Communist Party. And Saddam, the minute he came to power, destroyed all the opposition. The Iraqi communists were wiped out, there was brutal repression, the oil workers' trade union was banned, and he enjoyed good relations with the West. And then after the Iranian Revolution in 77-78, this event in Tehran, which toppled the Shah, was seen by all the crowned heads of the Arab world and the United States as a very big threat. So Saddam was encouraged by the United States and Britain to go to war with Iran. And it's at that time that he was supplied with weapons of all sorts, including chemical weapons. Some of his scientists came to Port and Round, the biological warfare laboratory in Britain, and were trained there. There is a very interesting photograph of Rumsfeld going to Baghdad to meet him on behalf of the Reagan regime and pledge support to him. So this is a monster who has been created and backed by the West. On the left, he's been hated for ages, and he's a pitiless and ruthless dictator. And what he's done to the Kurdish population, again, with the West turning a blind eye. I mean, the United States and Britain vetoed resolutions in the United Nations condemning him. So this is the origins of this particular regime. And the people who could have toppled this regime, the citizens of Iraq themselves, have been destroyed by the brutal and murderous regime of sanctions which has been imposed by the West for the last 12 years. I mean, these sanctions have had nil effect on the military elite running that country, but they really have wrecked the population.
Some would argue, having created this monster, the U.S. actually bears some responsibility to remove them. What would you say to that?
Well, Doug, the thing is, you know, I tend to feel that it's best that the monsters are removed by their own people, because in these circumstances, the development is organic and it's long-lasting and it establishes roots. However long it takes, it's the best way to go. What we now have is the worst of both worlds. I mean, if the United States goes in and removes him, I'm not saying that this will necessarily be unpopular with large sections of the population who feel passive, but then they will impose either their own regime, which will create turmoil in that country very, very soon after the initial euphoria of Saddam's removal has gone, And or they will impose a puppet regime like they've done in, you know, we'll have democracy Afghan style, which will not have the support of any of the major currents in Iraq itself. Why they will not allow democracy in Iraq is because of the ethnic composition of the country. 80% of the population consists of Shia Muslims. And because the West has been backing the religious leaders of these groups, they've strengthened them over the years against Saddam. So in any free election in Iraq, they would probably sweep the polls. You would then have a Shiite republic in Iraq and in Iran. And there's no doubt, given that all the holy cities of Shiism and in Iraq, there would be a big tendency to some sort of coalition between these two states, which would destabilize the Gulf, and which is something the United States is trying to resist. I think basically the United States would like to keep the minority Sunni Muslim elite in power in that country to keep the other parts of the Middle East happy, and would like to remove Saddam.
Well, let's talk about Iran a bit. That it looked for a while that the people here were getting rather tired of the rule by the mullahs, and their regime is looking a little wobbly. Being identified with the axis of evil seems to have strengthened their hand. What would a war in Iraq do in Iran, do you suppose?
Well, I mean, I have to say that I think the Iranian mullahs would be very happy if the United States toppled their old enemy. They will not say so publicly. This is where the State Department or the White House has been very foolish. The axis of evil, from their own point of view, was the most stupid thing they could have done, because they've immediately strengthened the hardliners in Tehran, who have been making strong noises against the war in Iraq. I don't think they'll do anything about it. But I think trouble could come if there is an American war in Iraq, an American occupation, and no democracy. And there will be, I think the Shiite population in Iraq will then probably come out onto the streets, and then what? Will Western soldiers crush uprisings? If they do, there will be, you know, Iran will explode again. I mean, I think it's a very, very difficult situation which they're going to find themselves in. Secondly, though, that inside Iran itself, the majority, 60% of the country's population is under 25 years of age. This is a generation which has grown up under the clerics. It knows nothing else, and it regards the Shah and all that preceded him as fairy tales. You know, some say even if they're true, okay, so what, we live under these people and we don't like it. So I think bubbling away in Tehran is a popular movement which is trying to reform the current state of affairs, but if the reforms don't succeed, I don't think it's impossible that within 4 or 5 years you could have a democratic uprising which gets rid of the clerics. I mean, the worst possible thing would be a U.S. intervention in that region, because that really would strengthen the hand of the clerics.
What about Saudi Arabia? There's been a lot of rumbling on the American right about how we should really drop them as an ally, and you could read the move against Iraq as an attempt to have a more pliant swing producer and maybe dispose of Saudi Arabia, or at least reduce its importance. What do you think?
Well, I think there is an element of truth in that. I think, you know, the difference, the big, big difference between pro-U.S. regimes in other parts of the world and the Arab world is this, that in many other parts of the world, you know, whether it was Indonesia or whether it's Britain, these are hard pro-U.S. Regimes. I mean, they really did control them. Whereas the control exercised by the United States on their Arab allies in the Middle East has always been very soft. They've never insisted on anything, largely because it was part of the Cold War, and they were just happy enough to have these regimes existing as they did. So while American political military influence was strong, American culture never penetrated these countries in the ways it did elsewhere. So including Egypt, it has to be said. So in both Egypt and Saudi Arabia, they have pro-American regimes without any real support from within the population as a whole. And this has not been, you know, I mean, it's created problems, as they saw after last September. So the occupation of Iraq one aim would be to have a regime which is totally theirs, does exactly what they want. And I think they will use this base then to try and change the regimes and the shape of the countries in that region, including probably Saudi Arabia. I mean, I think relations between Saudi Arabia and the United States have never been as bad as this since last September. Sections of the American establishment were deeply shocked by the fact that members of the royal family were taped, their telephones were tapped, and the tapes revealed exultation on the part of some of them. I think this did shock them. And they also know perfectly well that Al-Qaeda's temporary military base might be in Afghanistan, but the bulk of its cadres came from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. These are two staunch pro-US states in the region. So I think they will try and do something there, but it's very difficult at the moment to work out whether there's any unity amongst the American political military establishment for doing anything, Doug, because, you know, you hear the politicians saying we're going to do this, and the next day the director of the Central Intelligence Agency comes out and says Saddam does not pose a threat. I mean, it's quite staggering. So what that indicates to me is that they are very, very divided at the very top, and that they have not yet agreed on their war aims. And it's this lack of agreement on war aims which is making the American military very nervous indeed.
Let's return then to the theme of this, the show. Is Iraq really the first act in a long drama? I mean, the Cheney people around Cheney and Rumsfeld have a grand design for remaking the Middle East, or so they say, yeah, on paper. Do you think there's something to that? Or
I think there is something to that, but I think it will depend very much on the cost of it. I mean, the political cost of it and the cost of it in terms of blood. If they take Iraq, but at the cost of taking Iraq, I mean, basically they'll bomb it into bomb its cities and try and reduce it to rubble before they take it. But that will lead to a lot of civilian casualties in that country, and that will inflame the region. So that will not be the best possible way in which to try and reshape other parts of the Middle East. In fact, they'll find it very difficult to do so. But, I mean, the other possibility is that there will be some, I think they can do it militarily, they can overpower the country, but if they themselves lose, a few thousand bodies, say, but even that will be regarded by many people as too much, and that could put a stop to further adventures in the region. On the other hand, if they can somehow maneuver a virtually bloodless change of regime in Iraq and just do what they want, then that will encourage the hawks in the administration to say, look, it was easy. Let's do it in other countries as well.
Finally, what is your evaluation of the likelihood of that? Is it going to be bloodless or bloody? Will there the opposition collapse, or will it be stiff resistance?
I think there will be resistance. This is not the Taliban. You see, the thing about the Taliban was that they could melt away. They had a base in Pakistan where they came from, and they knew that they had to just sit it out. They could fight another day. Now, in a strange sort of a way, Saddam Hussein's base in that country is very limited. This is what will cause him to fight, because he'll know that, defeat means death. So he's totally against the wall, and I think he was sent messages saying that if he agreed to go quietly, he wouldn't be tried in the International Criminal Court, etc., etc. But he's refused all that, which means that there will be some resistance. But I think that resistance will be defeated by big, big worry is the number of civilian casualties, because Saddam will resist in the cities, and that's where the fighting will take place. But I think, that there will be resistance. I don't think the Iraqis will give up without any struggle at all, like the Taliban did.
How many people are willing to die for Saddam Hussein?
I would have thought his sort of hardcore is about 5 to 10,000 hardcore supporters who probably will be prepared to die for him. But it's the ones who don't particularly want to die are the ones who will be killed. I mean, these are the ones who will be killed by these large-scale bombing raids which are being planned.
Well, that grim note will conclude. Thank you for joining us, Tariq.
Thanks very much, Doug.